Ron Smith had just a couple days to receive a rabies vaccination. Besides the timeline, it wasn't an emergency, but he ended up in the emergency room. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. Today on the show, the cost of an emergency room visit. We'll hear more about Ron's story.
The total bill for both of us was $24,240, which was pretty shocking.
And we have two experts joining to help us understand these often high costs. An ER physician from Cedar Rapids and a hospital administration expert help us to answer the question, what's behind the numbers I see on my hospital bill? A look at emergency room billing after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. Healthcare, the Affordable Care Act, medical bills, insurance. Conversations on the state of our healthcare system are everywhere, with a focus on the question, how will we pay for all of this? But rarely do we ask the question, why are our healthcare costs so high to begin with? Iowa Public Radio is seeking to answer that question with a series on the cost of an emergency room visit. Most of us have an emergency room story, the car accident, the minor injury, the birth of a child. It can be emotional and scary, with little room for questions about how much a procedure costs, what insurance covers, or whether a test is truly needed. Judgment is left to the professionals. So today on the show, we hear from Iowans after their ER visit, Iowans who didn't know how much they would be charged until the bill showed up. As Iowa Public Radio's Duri Buscarin reports, that bill may look different depending on which hospital you visit.
No matter how you slice it, medical care is expensive, especially in an emergency. Martha Norbeck shuffles through paperwork as she looks back over her itemized hospital bill from a bike accident 5 months ago.
Just to have the guy come to the ER to do my stitches was $460, and then for the six stitches was $826, so that was 140 a stitch or something.
Because it was a head injury, nurses in the emergency room at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics suspected a concussion and ran a CT scan. That wound up as a $4,800 charge, and one Norbeck thinks could have been avoided.
I thought at the time, wow, maybe I should ask for just an x-ray. Like, I did occur to me, really, a CT scan? But I'm like, well, whatever. I mean, they know best, right?
Because Norbeck owns her own small business, she's self-insured with a high deductible. So every time she needs care, she's thinking about the bill she'll get afterwards.
You just close your eyes and pray. And I'm not even praying about my health. I'm praying about the cost.
According to an annual poll by Kaiser Health News, 57% of households with insurance have avoided or delayed some type of care in the past year due to cost, most often skipping dental checkups or relying on home remedies and over-the-counter drugs instead of seeing a doctor. But in an emergency, you don't have those choices.
First, we don't care. We don't care what your insurance status is. We're not going to worry about that. We're going to treat you and make sure that you're safe first.
Dr. Hans House is an emergency room physician at UIH. He says, yes, sometimes patients come in and say they're worried about paying a bill. That can be a tough conversation because even if a patient is stabilized, what if you miss something?
We might have different options for medical testing. We might be able to do a CT scan or an ultrasound or delay testing, and we're going to give you those options because whatever fits you best in terms of your own financial situation.
Because every procedure, consultation, x-ray, lab test, even a couple aspirin tablets taken in the ER has its own price and its own billing code in the hospital charge master. After negotiating rates, insurance companies and Medicare actually pay only a portion of the initial charges, so there's a markup built into each price. Richard Beloff is a healthcare administration professor at Des Moines University.
Charges that a hospital would generate are really a recouping of the fixed cost of actually having the facility there and then having it staffed.
UIH, for example, received approval last year to increase their charges by 6%, citing rising operating costs for the hospital and a number of construction projects. But Beloff says a hospital's administration also has to consider how many patients are covered by Medicare and Medicaid, which reimburse at a lower rate than private insurance.
If I wanted my ER to break even, and let's say that my self-pay patients pay 20 cents on the dollar because they just simply disappear, we call it a bad debt, that is a similar consideration than if I have a payer who does pay, but they pay less than others.
But at the end of the day, does it add up to that much of a difference? Well, Medicare provider charge data, which only became public last year through the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, shows the University of Iowa hospitals and clinics charging about $31,000 for treatment of an acute heart attack, a full $10,000 more than Mercy Hospital, just across the river. In Iowa City, I'm Duri Buscarin, Iowa Public Radio News.
And you're listening to River to River on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. We're looking at hospital billing on today's show, and specifically the cost of an emergency room visit. I'm joined this hour by Dr. Thomas Striegel, an emergency room physician at St. Luke's Hospital, Unity Point Health in Cedar Rapids. Welcome, Dr. Striegel.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
And hospital administration expert Daniel Zismer joins the conversation from Minnesota, where he serves as professor in the Division of Health Policy and Management at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. He's also the chair and director of the Masters in Healthcare Administration and Executive Studies programs. Welcome, Daniel.
Thanks, Emily. Pleasure to be here.
So we just heard in Duri's piece from Martha Norbeck in Iowa City, who described feeling vulnerable in the ER room. She's in no condition to be asking critical questions. And when she initially contacted us, she wrote that she felt at the doctor's mercy, saying they could charge me anything. Dr. Striegel, in what way does cost factor into the advice you give as a physician? Do you share the feelings of Dr. House in that piece?
Absolutely. When we are caring for people in the emergency department, number one thing that we're focused on is making sure that they stay safe, making sure that we rule out any life-threatening emergencies, but also trying to address their needs, the needs and concerns that they came into the emergency department with. And there are lots of options, but still, number one, we need to make sure that our patients are safe. And sometimes complaints can be very straightforward, but given our healthcare system, given our aging population, given the complexity of medical care in the United States, it's not always easy to find a direct line to a diagnosis, to treatment, and to ensure patient safety. So there's lots of factors that need to be taken into consideration.
Mm-hmm. Can you recall a time when you suspected you were with a patient and they either told you or you suspected that they would be unprepared to pay for a procedure? Maybe they told you they didn't have insurance. You know, how did that influence your decision making?
Well, Emily, I think that happens on a daily basis. Whenever I work in the emergency department, there's at least one patient, usually multiple patients, where the discussion of their care factors into financial concerns and their ability to pay or on their own, or what's left over after insurance pays for their care. And so we have that discussion. We talk about different options, but still the number one concern is of patient safety. And those are things that I address directly with the patients. Now, it's often difficult in my position. I don't know the exact cost of studies. I can give general ideas, tens of dollars, hundreds of dollars, thousands of dollars, but the exact cost often does fluctuate, especially the costs that come directly to the patient. But yes, that's a discussion that I will have frequently with patients in the emergency department.
Mm-hmm. So you're not privy to exactly how much a procedure will cost or the sticker price of that?
No, it's such a complex aspect of healthcare, and I actually think that Dr. Zismer could address this a little better. As a physician, we focus so much on our training in the science of medicine, in learning about the human body, how it operates, the disease processes, and then when we start practicing, our focus is on the science of medicine, plus the art of communicating with an individual to try to understand what it is that they're experiencing and turn that into a diagnosis. That's the emphasis of our training. That's the emphasis of what we do, and the billing, the cost associated with that is just as immense as is the body of work, the information associated with medicine. And it's truly another art and science in and of itself. But so the conversations I have with patients are more generalities. And I do the best that I can to talk to them and prepare them and allow them to make an informed decision. And I think that's the bottom line of what we do or attempt to do in any sort of medical care, is making sure that as reasonable as possible, an individual can make an informed decision about what's going on and what needs to be done to take care of them.
In preparation for this show, talking with patients and professionals in the field, a lot of people told us they cited excessive testing as a reason an ER visit can cost into the thousands. You know, for instance, you can be admitted into the ER for a headache, and there's a number of tests that the doctor may order. Insurance may not always reimburse for it, but the doctor wants to cover all their bases. They don't want a patient leaving and then suffering a serious injury because a specific test wasn't conducted. Do medical malpractice lawsuits affect the delivery of our healthcare nowadays?
Probably less than you might think. When you see patients presenting in emergency departments, there's a high probability that that physician has never seen that patient before. That patient may be complaining of multiple issues at the time of clinical presentation. There may not be a medical record on that patient at all. And when the physician starts asking questions and patients start answering, it's not as simple as treating a broken arm or a stabbing or a gunshot wound. There may be a number of complex issues presenting at that time. What's the physician to do? And I'm certainly not here defending all practices of emergency rooms. But the fact is, if there's a complex presentation, patient responds to a number of questions, clinical questions in the affirmative, there's almost an obligation to run those down on a part of the physician's attending. That patient leaves the emergency department, let's assume, is not admitted to the hospital. And the fact is, most are not admitted to a hospital from an emergency room. The physician wants to be sure that all reasonable bases are covered before that patient leaves. And more than likely, probably I would suggest 99% of the time, that physician is blinded to whether that patient has any insurance coverage or not, which frankly, in my opinion, is a good thing. They shouldn't be balancing their judgments based upon out-of-pocket payments or copays at that time.
Dr. Striegel, do you worry about malpractice lawsuits?
And I think it's impossible to operate in the healthcare system in the United States without considering professional liability at some level. Is it something that I think about with every patient that comes through the door? Absolutely not. My focus is still trying to understand the desires of the patient, the needs of the patient, and ensuring their safety. And I just can echo the things that Dr. Zietzmer has mentioned, that it's the most glorious thing about my job in the emergency department is I take care of people regardless of their ability to pay. I don't care about their insurance. I never check their insurance when I'm caring for them. The only time it becomes part of the discussion is if the patient brings it up. We focus on what is happening with them, what they're feeling, what they're thinking, and we work through the medical model to try to come up with answers. And only if they bring it up, I don't have any insurance. This is something I'm going to have to pay for myself. Well, we then start having that discussion about costs. But yeah, that is a great thing about my job, is that I get to focus on those patients and eliminate the additional layer of complexity by thinking about whether bills can get paid. But as far as the professional liability, as far as the risk associated with it, with my job, with taking care of patients, yes, it is something that we train on and we talk about in residency programs and even in medical school. We discuss professional liability and protecting oneself. But the bottom line is, we say the best way to protect yourself is to practice good evidence-based medicine. So that is definitely the focus of my care and the care of other physicians in the emergency setting.
You know, I would interject that perhaps even the specter or the potential for liability to increase if physicians started to have discussions in the emergency department about price, cost, and one's patient or a patient's ability to pay. So my experience would suggest that if that kind of conversation would be initiated by physicians, it may in fact raise the whole risk of the liability issue and the specter of liability, because obviously at that point the patient's going to wonder, what's the real motive here? Is the real motive to treat me properly in an urgent or emergent setting, or is it focused on my ability to pay? So while I'm not a lawyer, My suspicion is the lawyers that work for health systems would not want physicians to interject questions regarding cost and their ability to pay, unless, of course, a patient initiates and starts asking questions, and physicians would then be in a position to answer as best they could.
I want to address one other thing from Dury's piece. She mentioned the charge master of the hospital, and that's something I had not heard of until researching for this show. Daniel, can you explain, so the charge master contains all the billing codes for the hospital, but who's putting this together and how are they coming up with these prices?
Yeah, there's a really interesting issue when you look at real healthcare costs in the United States. And when we take a look over the last several years, actually the utilization rates have been coming down. And that's, I think, because physicians, hospitals, other professionals have been concerned about what really is evidence-based best practices. So we're beginning to do a pretty good job bringing down the unnecessary utilization rates. However, when you really take a look at the cost of care, there's this issue called price dislocation. And price dislocation basically means there's no common sense or rhyme or reason to how most health systems price. And frankly, there's relatively little relationship between price and what they actually get paid. When you take a look at the revenue structure of most complex health systems, Unity Point, for example, or an Align in Minneapolis, most likely about five payers deliver most of the revenue to that organization. It would be Medicare, Medicaid, and probably three commercial payers. And in the state of Iowa, there's one or two really prominent commercial payers. So those four or five payers that deliver most of the revenue to health systems really pay very little attention to price. That's a negotiated rate between the health system and the payer, and frankly, the government pays no attention to the negotiation at all. When you're Medicare or Medicaid, you basically deliver the contract as to stipulating what they're going to pay. So price really only makes a difference at the end of the day to those who have a means to pay but have no coverage. Those that have no means to pay, there's what's called a bad debt write-off. And when you take a look at who really pays retail, it would be, for example, the small business owner that wouldn't have health insurance or would have a high deductible that they would be paying out of their pocket. Frankly, very few hospitals, hospitals in existing markets or the same or similar markets are restricted from getting together and talking about price. That would be a per se violation of the antitrust law under the price fixing chapters or statutes. So at the end of the day, for better or for worse, price makes relatively little difference. Now, the charge master. The charge master is a very long list of everything sold to patients, and everything has a price. So you may see a health system say, well, we just got approval from our board to raise our prices 6% next year. The fact is that 6% price increase is going to affect only a minority of the patients that derive services from that health systems. As I said, most of the services delivered and covered by the government or insurance pay a rate that really has very little bearing on the price that exists on the charge master. So think of it as the price list, the menu outside the restaurant. You want to buy a hamburger, it's priced at $8, but the fact is I get a special rate and I'm paying $4.50 because I have pricing leverage in a market as an insurance company, for example.
Mm-hmm. And an insurance negotiation is something that we will cover as we continue this series. Before the end of the segment, I'd like to talk about Medicare for a little bit. According to the Iowa Medical Society, Medicare reimbursement to Iowa physicians ranks among the lowest in the country. So how does low reimbursement factor into the issue of rising medical costs?
Well, I'll take a first shot at that, if you don't mind. When you take a look at how Medicare reimbursement has been set over the years, it varies by region of the country. The fact is, when you look at the Midwest, you look at Minnesota, Iowa, Wisconsin, the Dakotas, there has been historically a pretty conservative approach to the practice of medicine, which is a positive thing when I say a conservative approach. Consequently, the price per Medicare enrollee, or the costs for Medicare enrollees have been significantly less for a long period of time as compared with, for example, Florida. So frankly, the healthcare systems in the Midwest have been penalized for their more conservative practical approach and what I would call evidence-based best practice approach. So the same service delivered in Minnesota in an emergency department is likely to be a lot less from a cost perspective to Medicare than that same service delivered in another part of the United States.
And Dr. Striegel, where you are you feeling low Medicare reimbursement?
Well, we've noticed within the private practice that I'm a part of, we've noticed a downward trend in reimbursements over the past 3 years. We average around 50%, but every year it gets a little lower and lower. And we are in a position because it's I don't know if describing it as a purely competitive environment or one where there's little control by the physicians. We've just realized as a group that this is the trend. There's nothing that, as physicians, we are able to do about it within our group. Some of our professional organizations do lobby and represent us as physicians, but as a group, that the only way that we can protect ourselves is to become more efficient and to strengthen our margin, but that increased reimbursements are a thing of the past, and they will continue to trend lower. And looking at the American College of Emergency Physicians, their information, they feel that this is a trend across the country, not just something that's unique to Iowa. And it is the future, that there is going to be less power, less control on a physician basis regarding their reimbursements, and that, again, strengthening their margin, tightening their bottom line is going to be the only way to remain profitable.
We're talking hospital ER costs this hour. I'm joined by Dr. Thomas Striegel of St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids and Daniel Zismer from the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. Coming up after the break, we hear stories from listeners about their experience in the ER and the hospital bills they received, including a story from an Indianola resident whose vaccination cost him thousands of dollars. The stories that you'll hear were submitted by listeners through Iowa Public Radio's Insight Network, and we encourage you to join our network as well. In short, our Public Insight Network is a way that we can connect with the public on stories and issues that matter to Iowa, to your community. So if you hear a story on today's program on hospital billing and you say to yourself, "Yep, I know exactly how that feels," consider contacting us today. You can also email us at the email address investigatethis@iowapublicradio.org. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to River to River from Iowa Public Radio. River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. We're spending this hour examining the unknown and complex world of hospital billing, and specifically the cost of an emergency room visit. The Investigate This ER Costs series is a collaborative effort between our reporters and our talk show team, and in preparation for the series, Iowa Public Radio reached out to you, our listeners, to get your stories, your billing questions, and we have several guests joining us today to help you better understand the reasons behind the numbers you see on your bill. With me today, Dr. Thomas Striegel, an emergency room physician at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids, and hospital administration expert Daniel Zismer, a professor and director within the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. Let's listen to a couple stories from listeners who visited the emergency room recently. This first story comes from Ron Smith in Indianola.
Last September, my wife and I woke up and there was a bat flying around our bedroom. And we were lucky enough to have it, and we took it to the Iowa Department of Health to be tested. And the test came back inconclusive, which means they couldn't tell if it had rabies or not. So they highly recommended that we receive rabies vaccinations.
Sure, because that's scary. That's something that you need to take care of right away, correct?
We did have a few days, since we didn't have a specific bite that they could point to. I guess bat bites are very subtle, and you really don't know if you've been bitten or not. So they always err on the side of having vaccinations. But so I did have a few days to investigate. I called the insurance company and asked if we were covered, and they said that we were. And they encouraged us to go to our local clinic where we would have a $25 copay. And I called the local clinic, and they said they did not give rabies shots and referred me to Iowa Methodist. And called around several other places, and I called the Iowa Department of Health back, and everyone just kept referring us to the emergency room.
Okay, so you go to the hospital, you have this potentially fatal disease that you need a vaccination to, you know, ward off if you did get bitten by the bat. So you go get the shots, and then you come away from it, receive a bill from the hospital. What did that look like?
Well, the total bill for both of us was $24,240, which was pretty shocking.
Yeah, that's a pretty big bill. Did you ask about it? Did you investigate those costs on your own a little bit?
You know, I did ask before we had the treatment or the shots how much it was going to cost, and no one could ever tell us. All we heard was, they're sort of expensive. But we didn't hear it's going to be over $20,000 or anything like that.
Mm.
I did call the hospital, and I called the insurance company, and really got nowhere. The insurance write-off was $17,627. So the insurance company got a discount of that. And the insurance company paid $2,135, and we had $2,000 deductible, so we paid, and then we paid a certain percentage after that, which was $4,482. If we had been able to obtain the services at our local clinic, it would have cost us about $200.
So, Ron, after this experience, you know, you don't have rabies now. You got the vaccination. You're doing well. But what questions do you have about your bill?
Well, we were really fortunate. First of all, we didn't get rabies. And second of all, we did have insurance. And third, you know, we were able to pay the deductibles. But the big question, or the general question, is why did it cost so much? And more specifically, if the hospital is a not-for-profit corporation, and the original bill of $24,000 reflects their actual costs and expenses, how could they afford a $17,000 loss after the insurance company write-off? And I guess the other side of that is, if the $24,000 bill doesn't reflect their actual costs and expenses, how can they justify a $17,000 profit from someone who's uninsured?
So Daniel Zismer, as a hospital administration expert, when you hear that story and that question, a not-for-profit hospital, how did they come up with that price? I mean, $24,000 is a huge number for a vaccination, but then it went down a lot.
The fact is the not-for-profit status really isn't the issue, however, because most hospitals in the United States are not-for-profit tax-exempt organizations. Doesn't mean, however, they don't have to make a profit, because they do have to make a profit. Otherwise, they don't stay in business. You know, upwards of 60% of the cost of running a health system is people. So people want to get paid, and people want to get raises, et cetera. Now, back to the question. I don't know how the hospital prices, that particular hospital prices a series of vaccinations for rabies, so I can't speak intelligently to that. The issue, however, the bigger issue at hand is the affordability question, which your listener put. The fact is, as we talked about insurance companies before, about 2 to 3 commercial insurers constitute most of the profitability for hospitals. In fact, many hospital administrators would suggest that they lose money on Medicare and Medicaid, which is a debatable point for another time, but let's accept that for the moment. The fact is, the operating losses earned from people that don't pay their bills, or the operating losses earned from the governmental payers of Medicare or Medicaid, get shifted. Those deficits get shifted to the handful of payers that are in a position to pay at a profit. And those cost shifts result in double-digit pricing increases, which compound over decades. So that's one of the reasons why premiums have gone up at such a rapid and compounded rate over the years.
As we're having this conversation on emergency room costs, I know our listeners are thinking about the $15 aspirin. That's the most quoted hospital cost. And as a comparison, I went to the Iowa City CVS, calculated per pill. One Bayer aspirin costs 10 cents and a generic is only 2 cents. And we also have a real life example about prescription medication from Jan Gerstner in Delafield, Wisconsin. She ended up in the ER after a recovery from a heart surgery that left her feeling weak. She writes that on her bill, there was a $300 charge for aspirin. She was told that covered the cost of the nurse who administered and delivered the prescription and that different departments were being consulted. Dr. Striegel, can you speak to how many people are involved in this emergency room treatment? It's not always the physicians you see in the emergency room, is it?
No, it absolutely is not. In addition to the individuals that a patient will come in contact with during their time in the emergency department, the physician, the nursing staff, the technician staff, the patient care technicians, laboratory staff members, radiology staff members, there are other people that never even meet the patient that are working for them. The unit secretaries or assistants, you think of the radiologist who are overviewing their studies, the laboratory physicians who are responsible for ensuring that all of the equipment is calibrated and functioning properly. Look at all the technicians who maintain those equipment and the number of individuals that contribute to that individual's care just increases exponentially. And these are people that are unseen by the patient in that emergency department. Now, how that figures into the cost, again, as a physician who provides care, I cannot speak intelligibly about the cost shifting and where that appears on a patient's bill. But very easily, when you enter an emergency department, the resources that you have available to you to ensure that you're safe are phenomenal, and they're very large. And that is one of the reasons that care can be more expensive in an emergency department. It's simply the resources at your disposal.
Another statement from Jan, she said that the hospital would not allow her to use her prescription medications that she was using before they admitted her. So this is quoting her, even though I knew they were charging far more than I would otherwise pay, I had no choice if I was to receive them. Dr. Striegel, can you speak to why someone can't take their own medication in the ER? Sure it's a control factor, but let's say you're prescribed something and you have it in your purse, why can't you just take the one that you have?
Well, I definitely cannot speak to that particular situation. It is not uncommon in the emergency department if a patient does have their chronic medications with them, their previously prescribed medications, that they can use those medications if they're indicated, if they're safe in that situation, and if the patient has absolute certainty that that is the medication that is in their possession. And it would be a matter of allowing that patient and discussing it with them to consume that medication on their own. And a lot of that is simply a matter of liability. As there are so many medications out there that are not easily identifiable just by the pill type, And it's frequent that patients will say, oh, I don't remember the name of my medicine, but it's a little white pill and it has pink dots on it. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry to say, I simply cannot identify medications by a description like that. So there's risk. There's risk when a patient says, I'd like to take my own medication. I have it with me. Is that okay? We leave it up to the patient. As long as we feel that it's safe in that situation, they can. Now, there may be other situations where we don't allow them to take medications. As an example, if they're in my emergency department and I'm caring for them and I'm still in the process of determining, is their problem something that's surgical? Would they potentially need to have an emergent surgical procedure? One of the important things that we have to consider is that they have an empty stomach, and even a small tablet can pose risk should that patient have to go in for an emergent procedure and need general anesthetic, and there could be an aspiration risk that's increased. It's simply because of a tiny tablet that they've consumed. So that would be an example where I would not want a patient to take one of their medications by mouth at that particular moment. But there generally is some flexibility with regards to chronic medications. Can they be consumed by the patient in the manner that they are supposed to be taken? However, there are circumstances where it's not a possibility. But generally, hospitals have some degree of flexibility in working with the pharmacy staff.
Our next listener submission comes from Seamus O'Brien from Shoalsburg, Wisconsin, a former resident of Dubuque.
I went to the ER for 7 sutures that I received because I was doing some woodworking and I slipped and cut myself with a carbon steel blade. So just knew that I need it right away and was able to put pressure on it and get to the ER, or end up walking to the ER. And when I got there, I had to fill out a lot of documentation while I had pressure on my hand, and then received the care and the treatment. But in the end, I guess I have pretty good insurance, and even though it is good insurance, I still had a deductible to meet, which was $500, and then I had to pay the 20% of the remaining cost, which ended up being about $50 or so. So,
would knowing the price have changed what treatment you accepted?
I think it may have. I mean, there are certain things to consider. I mean, there's anesthesia and other things that, I mean, I guess that's up to the doctor and their discretion as to what they wish to use. And in other circumstances where it may be to a lesser degree, maybe I didn't need quite as many stitches or something, yeah, I might have considered, you know, using butterflies or something, you know, to get you by until acute care could be gotten, or, you know, just gone in during the day or whatever the case may be.
And this happened to you again. A similar situation happened a little bit later.
Yeah, actually, let's see, it probably would have been about three or four years later or recently now. I just got a cut right above on my other hand, actually. And I, knowing that I was going to need a few stitches, and at the time it was, I kind of thought back to my experience before and just realized that, you know, this is probably something I can take care of myself. So I just gave myself 3 sutures.
Wow.
You know, sterilized everything and did it myself. And I did not have any infection. And it didn't cost me, well, it cost me about $5 worth of fishing a line.
Well, that is very brave of you. So, Seamus, you know, the second time around, you did things differently. You took your own health care into your own hands, which not many people can do in situations, but you were able to do in this situation and save yourself some money. After both of these experiences, what question do you have for experts on today's show?
I guess my question is, are doctors, care providers, insurance providers routinely providing the information to customers as to how much this is actually going to cost, and maybe providing some kind of recommendations as to, yeah, this is worth being in the ER here, or you know, maybe, you know, you might try using a butterfly or whatever the case may be. trying to understand the difference between an emergency and, you know, what's really not life-threatening and what can wait.
So to sum up Seamus's question, Dr. Striegel, is it ever acceptable for you to provide patients with alternatives or recommend that they take care of it on their own, maybe go to a clinic, go somewhere else? Or do you leave that up to the patient?
Well, we definitely have that discussion. There have been times when a patient has come in to me, they've asked my opinion about either a medical problem or and specifically a laceration, and I've provided them with options and said, well, yes, we can put sutures into a laceration, and it may decrease the amount of scarring, or we can do absolutely nothing, and it will heal, and it will just take a little longer to heal. It will have a little larger scar, but still should do just fine. And if there's any complications, they can come back and see us then. And there are times when people say, okay, I don't want anything done. I'll just wait. I'll watch. There are a number of situations where I or other physicians may offer a therapy, give our best professional opinion, and still leave it up to the patient, because ultimately in everything that we do with patient care, it's a partnership.
Daniel, do you see the industry shifting to more clinics with nurse practitioners, medical offices staying open late to help keep patients out of the emergency room?
I do. When you take a look at what I would call the larger, more sophisticated health systems, including those in Iowa, they are very interested in cost of care for several perspectives. First of all, just simply to try to minimize the kinds of circumstances that we're talking about today, but also to provide better, less costly access to urgent care as compared with emergency care. When you take a look at the types of clinical conditions that are treated in emergency rooms, most of them aren't emergencies. They're usually cases where, A, an alternative wasn't available to the patient, their own doctor's office wasn't open, or there was no sophisticated urgent care center. And consequently, the rational thing to do is to go to the emergency room. And so that the more sophisticated, complex health systems are trying to provide what I would call much more cost-effective urgent care environment. The fact is, while this may sound counterintuitive, most health systems don't want people in their emergency rooms that don't have emergencies. So when you look at the health systems in Iowa or Minnesota, they would much prefer to have people with lower acuity issues dealt with in an environment that can handle urgent situations properly with qualified physicians and other professionals, but not necessarily be putting four or five stitches in an emergency room. That emergency room is much too expensive a cost structure to be used for stitches. But absent the availability of something else that the patients understand and have access to, it's rational for them to go to the emergency room. It's just that, as we've said before, you have the most expensive structure available and cost structure available 24/7, and you could be administering four stitches for somebody who cut their hand in a workshop, or you could be trying to save somebody's life from a gunshot wound using that same staff.
And we're coming up on the end of the hour, but before I let you go, you know, we have people predicting that people will go to the emergency room less because they have insurance. They can go to a primary care provider. Some predict that they will go more because they have insurance. Daniel Zismer, if you had to pick one way the Affordable Care Act is really going to change emergency rooms, what would you pick?
I think the Affordable Care Act will cause, as I just suggested, the larger, more sophisticated, complex health systems to be devising more cost-effective ways to urgent care. And that's a very important distinction here. We've talked about emergency departments, but most of the things we talked about today are not clinical emergencies. So given health reform, the Affordable Care Act, more transparency on cost, and health system strategies to bring down both price and cost, I'm seeing on a national level, the larger health systems coming up with more accessible, cost-effective ways for treating more urgent issues without clogging up emergency rooms with people who don't need to be there, which frankly is better for the patient, and it's better and the more reasonable thing to do for the health systems as well.
What a fascinating discussion this hour. We covered a lot of ground. Hospital emergency room costs. Thank you to my guests, Dr. Thomas Striegel of St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids and Daniel Zismer from the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. Thanks to you both.
You're very welcome, Emily, and I thank you for giving me this opportunity.
Thanks for having us, Emily.
And just a reminder that the firsthand accounts you heard on today's show were listener-submitted stories, and you can join our conversation too. Join our Public Insight Network via our website. Email us your questions at investigatethis@iowapublicradio.org and interact with us on Twitter at IPRTalk, on Facebook, and on Iowa Public Radio's Tumblr page at iowapublicradio.tumblr.com. River to River is produced by Ben Stanton and Sarah Bowden. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from John Pemble and Dennis Reese. The reporting you heard at the beginning of the program is from IPR's Duri Buscarin. I'm Emily Woodbury. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.